Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, a local group dedicated to civility, understanding, and respect honors a local activist for her work on community justice. Later in the program, what you need to know about dairy cows with bird flu and how Ozempic may impact fertility. Dr. Joe Servin makes his monthly house call. But first, it sounds like something of an outlier these days, a group devoted to pulling communities together through civil discourse. One Jacks traces its origins back 54 years, and this week, One Jacks presents its annual humanitarian awards. To discuss that, we'll be joined in a moment by One Jacks CEO, Elizabeth Anderson. And here I'm joined by Rihanna Seister, who will be honored as a humanitarian with the Acosta Rua Young Professional Award. Good morning, Rihanna.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
So, first of all, congratulations. You know, last year you actually emceed this award for One Jacks, and this year you are the recipient. What? Tell us a little bit about the turnaround there.
It was quite the turnaround from here's the awards to, oh, I'm getting an award. But it's been a lot of fun and a good adventure to stay involved with the One Jacks family and all that they're doing.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. You're originally from St. Pete.
Yeah.
But born you've been raised. Here.
Yeah, I've been here since 2012. Started off at JU, but graduated from UNF and then went back to JU for my master's. So a little bit of back and forth, but I feel really deeply rooted here in Jacks. Over 10 years is a long time to kind of make your mark. So just having the network and the family that I have here has been the best.
Yeah. And so you've gone to school here, but you've also taught school here. You have kind of an education background.
Yeah, education is certainly the foundation for a lot of what I do. And that's kind of what drove me into becoming a teacher of students with disabilities. I taught for 4 years at the middle school level. So that was always a lot of fun.
That's an interesting task.
Certainly felt like reaching back to being the teacher that my teachers were for me and providing my students with the care that, you know, that they deserved.
And so you initially worked with exceptional children.
Yes.
But then you kind of moved on. Talk a little bit about that evolution.
Yeah, it was a bit of an awakening to be a teacher for about 2.5 years and then realize that the changes that I wanted to see in education were not happening from the classroom. And while I love my students and I wish I could take them with me everywhere I go, a lot of the changes that, you know, we want to see in education are happening from a policy space. So that's what drove me into getting my master's in public policy and really focused on educational equity.
And so when you say the changes that you wanted to see happening weren't happening in the classroom level, what were some of those changes that you felt needed to happen?
So I did my research on discipline and the practices that we use in schools and really zoned in on how discipline practices reflect our prison system and our jail population and how we can build a more restorative culture versus cultures of compliance. I think how we treat students when they are misbehaving or they don't comply with the rules that we set out for them says a lot about us. And I think it says a lot about society, right? How we treat those that have wronged society or how we treat those that have broken the law. Are we still able to treat them with grace and restore those relationships? And so that is the premise of, you know, my personal passion and my research. And that is kind of where I focused a lot of attention as a teacher because it, you know, discipline certainly impacts academic outcomes and the pot and the attitude towards school.
And when you talk about it being reflective of jails or prisons, you mean just being purely punitive as opposed to something that can help somebody recover or grow or change?
Yeah, so I always consider it like the culture of compliance where we just want you to come in and sit down and do what we say and learn this material and that's it. Versus utilizing the importance of student voice and allowing them to create a more positive, less punitive culture. I think that allowing student leadership in schools is imperative to really creating buy-in from students and having their say-so in curriculum development or lessons that we teach them in the classroom. So really elevating student voice and moving away from a culture of compliance to more restorative and culturally responsive methods.
And so when that translates to policy goals, what specifically do you aim for? What is a priority of yours, for instance?
So I put out actually 8 different policy recommendations that range from the district to state level. Some of those include getting rid of exclusionary discipline practices in the elementary school level.
What is that?
And so exclusionary discipline practices look like expelling a student, in-school suspension, or at-home suspension. And so those are all 3 different practices that remove the student from their learning environment. And so when we remove the student from the learning environment, we create disconnection. Disconnection is the root of misbehavior. It's the root of a lot of trauma that our students experience. And so a lot of the policy recommendations that I make are heavily based on how do we keep students included. And so doing away with campus arrests or doing away with exclusionary practices on an elementary school level creates opportunities for students to be more integrated. I also recommend developing a student leadership council, a student leadership council specifically dedicated to reviewing discipline practices and ensuring that we are being fair and equitable in our distribution of things like referrals or suspension or timeouts, things like that, to make sure students have voice and that we are being equitable in our practices.
The research that I've seen, and it's been a few years, but I remember there being a study done, and the numbers of people who were children in K through 5 who were being suspended,
yes,
or even arrested, mm-hmm, was really shocking.
Yeah.
But it also had some stark racial disparities.
Absolutely.
So is that something that your own research has borne out?
That is the premise of my research. It's specific here in Florida, but it's a national issue where we see that Black and Hispanic students are disproportionately disciplined to their rate of the population versus the rate that they are disciplined. And all research pretty much tells you that Black and Latina students are not misbehaving at a disproportionately higher rate, just like Black and Latino people are not committing crime at a disproportionately higher rate. But if you have an area where you are over-policed and you're over-reported, then you're over-disciplined. And so those disparities have existed for a long time. And the root of that is certainly school culture, teacher perception, administrative perception of student behavior, and a lack of cultural consciousness.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I think so many people are pushing for a more diverse administrative population and more diverse teacher population.
100%.
Yeah. I think we're joined now by Elizabeth Anderson of One Jax. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. I'm sorry I couldn't be with you in the studio this morning.
That's no problem. We're so glad that you could be here. So you are still relatively new to One Jax. You're a former chair of the school board here in Duval County. Tell us a little bit, though, about these awards that Rihanna is going to get one of, the main one. How important are those for One Jax? What's the significance?
Sure. I mean, I think Rihanna has given you a great snapshot of why she is one of the outstanding individuals who dedicate an unwavering commitment to our community. And so we look forward to honoring her with the Acosta Ruo Young Professionals Humanitarian Award this Thursday, May 9th, for our 2024 54th Humanitarian Awards event. As you know, One Jax is an organization dedicated to recognizing our diversity and respecting each other and fostering civility throughout the community. And so folks that had dedicated their lives to that and made commitments in our community to moving us forward will be honored. We have Martha Baker, Bill Bond, Jeff Edwards, and Brian Wolfberg all receiving silver medallions this year.
So the One Jax dates back to 1970. It was formed in Jacksonville as the local chapter of the National Conference of Christians and Jews, and it later became the National Conference for Community and Justice. Now, One Jax kind of separated, but has continued to carry forth, you know, the goal of being inclusive of race, ethnicity, diversity, sexual orientation, and identity. Are those conversations getting more difficult?
You know, I don't think that they're getting more difficult. I think they've always been difficult. Working on issues like social justice and religion, sexual orientation, identity, these are things that are challenging. We know ourselves, but the other sometimes can be scary. And so when we can bring people together, expand our bubble, and learn a little bit about the other person, maybe an identity or experience that they have had that helps us relate to them, we notice that we can see each other and our similarities a little bit easier. And that helps us get along in the community. So I don't think that it's harder necessarily than it's been. I think it's broader. I think that the ways that we identify certainly continue to grow. And so being careful not to find ourselves committed to our own little in-group and being able to share community with people that are different than us and really harnessing our strengths and similarities is certainly a challenge.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the upcoming One Jax Humanitarian Awards with this year's honoree and the group's CEO. You can join our conversation live on air by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or reach out on social media. We're joined now by Stanley in downtown. Good morning, Stanley.
Yes, good morning to everyone. This young lady here, I didn't get the full name, but she is brilliant. She is the future. They need to listen to her. We need to do a event and just listen to her for at least 2 hours because she needs to get her award and she needs to get paid. Plus, we need to listen to her because she is brilliant. Thank you.
Yeah, well, Stanley, the name is Rihanna Seister. Rihanna, obviously some recognition out there for you for the work that you're doing. And it is important work.
Thank you. Yeah. That was incredible.
Oh,
wow.
Very touched there. Yeah. Elizabeth, I want to circle back on something you said, because you're talking about how, you know, certain conversations have always been difficult, particularly around race, sexual identity. I think the thing that seems to be different to me is that the questions of divisions between faiths have become a little bit more pronounced. And I'm thinking, you know, about the rise of Christian nationalism, more recently, the tensions between the Jewish community in support of Israel and people who support the Palestinian cause, sort of becoming a matter of also religious tension. Does that conversation, do those rifts or those, you know, larger societal splits make all of the conversations more difficult that have been difficult from the start?
Sure. I mean, I think that there is no denying that tensions are really tough right now, especially as it relates to conflict that, you know, is happening halfway around the world. And when we think about the diversity of religions and faith traditions that we experience in our community, sometimes we're just not aware of how diverse the community is. The Islamic Center of Northeast Florida, for example, they are home base for more than 10,000 Muslim families in our community. And so we may be unaware that the people working next to us or sitting next to us in school pray to someone different than we do, or maybe don't have a faith at all. But it's our job to learn, to be open, to be accepting, and to really listen to one another. I don't think we're going to get through these difficult and challenging times continuing to turn away from one another. Certainly tensions are high. And when you put, you know, religion and nationalism and then American politics on top of that, we're in a very heated moment, I think, historically. And it is that much more important that we turn toward each other and not away.
Sure. And the, you know, protests that we've seen, at least locally here on campus at UNF, you know, it comes at a time when One Jax and basically the interfaith mission was forced out of that school. And every public school in Florida at the higher education level, all of their DEI initiatives shuttered. That included the Women's Center and the LGBTQ Center, but also the Interfaith Center. Can you talk a little bit about what it's meant to have to leave UNF? I mean, One Jax used to be an integral partner with the school there.
Sure. One Jax spent more than 10 years as an institute of UNF on campus there. And we decided to separate just about, I guess, 9 months ago, last July, kind of knowing that public universities would no longer be able to support DEI initiatives. And so now that we're seeing the shuttering of the LGBTQ Center, the Women's Center, the Interfaith Center, I am worried for the young people. I think there's opportunity for them to step up and have their own student-led groups and organizations. But it is important that we have, you know, unbiased, safe spaces to help guide these young people. When there's a center to come to, they're able to receive adult support. They're able to receive guidance. And that's really important at a time like this. I know our interfaith efforts, especially on university campuses through our Interfaith Campus Connect, continue to try to bring people together so that we can have dialogue, so that we can understand each other's perspectives respectfully, and we're not just yelling and protesting and marching without a means to an end. What is the end here? And so I think that it's important, especially as young people are developing and their minds are still moldable, whether we're talking about our high school or middle school students who we serve through our Sandy Miller Metrotown programs, or our college kids that we are continuing to work with through Campus Connect, helping young people not only understand themselves and their own identities, but also recognize other people's identities, remove bias, help foster civil discourse. These are all really important pieces to the conversation. And it's unfortunate that we are at a time where our public university system does not have a replacement for how to help students through this really charged emotional time.
Yeah.
Our kids still need guidance.
True at the higher education level, but also at the district level. You know, some people will know, Elizabeth, that you were challenged by somebody who, you know, had a political backing from the state, from the governor, from the Moms for Liberty group. And that was, you know, a displacement. So how does that trend affect, you know, initiatives that somebody like Rihanna is working on at the more local school district level?
Certainly, I think we see divisive politics across the board. I mean, we're about to go into an election season that I feel certain will have more divisive rhetoric. And it creates real challenges. There are people like Rihanna, for example, who's an incredible humanitarian, and I can't wait to honor her with this award and give her the platform she deserves for the work that she's doing across the community. Because, unfortunately, the politics co-opt language and use words like woke and indoctrination that unfortunately drive us further apart. Understanding that we are a diverse community is a fact. Working toward inclusion, these are actions that are admirable. I think that across the board, as I've gone out and I've met with business partners and community leaders and philanthropists, we are all still dedicated to making sure that this community honors and recognizes our diversity and creates a safe space to come together so that we can hear one another's perspective. And it is really unfortunate in classrooms, especially for our young people, that there may be initiatives, efforts to actively avoid bringing people together. Because we're afraid of being different, because we're afraid of feeling uncomfortable. I can understand not wanting to make someone feel bad, a child feel bad that they, you know, are wrong by virtue of the color of their skin. But I think it is okay for us to recognize that our skin color may be different. That's okay, but there's probably a lot more that we have in common, and we should celebrate that and give each other the space to share that. Not turn away from each other and not be afraid of hard conversations.
Rihanna, it's interesting the debate over, you know, what can be taught and how and who feels bad. And I think that one thing that's often overlooked is, you know, when you are a person of color learning about the, you know, horrendous treatment of people who were enslaved in this country, for instance, or if you're, you know, an indigenous person and you're learning about how, you know, Native Americans were driven out of their homes, surely that makes those students feel pretty bad. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just a question of, you know, kind of a majority community feeling guilty for actions possibly perpetrated by people that they are descended from, you know, not directly responsible for, but descended from. And but the flip side that doesn't often get explored is how bad learning about that can be, I think, for, mm-hmm. you know, people who've descended from those groups of people.
Yeah, I think learning is empowering, though. If we don't learn it, then we're bound to repeat it. But we're also not really having our children walk in truth. It's a reality, and it can't be erased no matter how much we try to erase it and reword it and reframe it to it was beneficial. We know that that is not truth. And so I'm always big on, you know, even little people can deal with big feelings if they have the right support. And if we are acknowledging, you know, like Elizabeth said, like perhaps it's not full throttle, you know, what happened. But if we break it down in a way that is honest and truthful for them, because, I mean, as a Black girl growing up, I quickly learned like, oh, I'm Black and this is what the world looks like for me. And so my white counterparts on the other end can also learn that truth. And that, I mean, that's just more empowering for us both. But to censor it in a way like we don't want anyone to feel bad or feel guilty, it's almost like censoring history. And, you know, no one can move forward with that. So I think both sides can handle truth if we do it the right way.
You serve as a board member for the Sanctuary on 8th Street. For people who may not be familiar with that group, tell us what they do.
It is my favorite place mm-hmm. in Jacksonville. I started working for the Sanctuary on 8th Street as a teacher over the summer. It is an after-school and summer program for children elementary through high school, and they serve the population of students who are, you know, predominantly downtown or in that area, and they do incredible work. I mean, students are extremely enriched. We do golfing, we do skateboarding, we go swimming twice a week, but it is an incredible, incredible place.
And they do have summer programs. I think it's mm-hmm. probably time that people could start thinking about
signing
up for those. Yeah,
for sure.
So, Elizabeth, this award recognizes Rihanna for her work. What does it mean to be a humanitarian? And what kind of mantle is she taking on when she accepts this award?
Sure. Rihanna will join what we love to call the One Jack Circle of honorees. And she is preceded by, 54 years worth. So probably hundreds at this point of individuals who have dedicated themselves to our community and demonstrated a commitment to bringing people together and joining in our shared humanity. And so we are so excited to bring her to the circle. The Acosta Rua Young Professionals Award, I don't know this exact date because I'm only 90 days on the job. But I'll find out before Thursday, maybe that's a good idea. The Acosta Rua Young Professionals Award is a newer award. And I think it really gives us an opportunity to start to highlight young people like Rihanna, who will be our future leaders. I think we've heard from the caller already today that we need to hear more from her. And so the opportunity to be able to highlight her and help her stand out as an up and coming leader and already a humanitarian is something I'm certainly looking forward to this Thursday.
Is this event like open to the public or is it more of a private event?
Certainly the event is open to the public. We do have some incredible sponsors this year who have made the event possible. People can find out more information about getting tickets or the event in general on our website at onejacks.org. But it is open and everyone is welcome.
And Rihanna, I just have to say, you're a big reader. Your Instagram is full of books. What are you reading now or what are you recommending?
And I'm going to be honest. I have not read in a while because I've been coping with life changes and pregnancies. So I'm like, okay, wait a minute. So I have not read in a while, but the last audiobook I listened to was really good. It was called Stay With Me. I don't remember the author's name, but incredible audiobook, narrated by a Nigerian author. So it was really good to have a switch up in author's narrator's voice. But I always have recommendations. My favorite book is Native Son by Richard Wright. I read the book in high school. It was assigned to me, and I will always recommend that as my top read. For anyone who's interested in the disproportionate discipline or the criminalization of Black youth, I recommend Kristen Henning. I can't remember the name of it. Author is Kristen Henning. It was written not too long ago, but I recommend that author for that specific topic.
All right. Well, sure. Congratulations on your pregnancy. You. Congratulations on the Humanitarian Award. Elizabeth Anderson and Rihanna Seister, thank you so much for being here and coming on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Up next, avian flu and surprise pregnancies. Dr. Joe takes your calls and fills us in on healthcare headlines. Welcome back. For the past 4 months, scientists now believe avian flu has been spreading through dairy cows in several states. And since then, the highly virulent virus has jumped into poultry, cats, and at least one human. Here to catch us up on what we need to know is our own Dr. Joe Servin of What's Health Got to Do With It, which airs on WJCT every Saturday at 4. Welcome, Dr. Joe.
And always a pleasure to see you.
It's a pleasure to have you. So Dr. Joe makes a house call to our program once a month to talk medical news and to take your calls and questions. You can reach out to Dr. Joe at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can call us at 904-549-2937. And if you don't want your name used, that's all right. You can just tell us. Dr. Joe, I want to get to the bird flu in just a minute, but first I want to touch a story that's on the front page of the Sunday New York Times. Actually, I have it here, a little visual display. So this is asking whether the medical establishment ignored or downplayed serious harm caused by COVID vaccines. What's being talked about here?
In that article is basically looking at what are the side effects of the COVID-19 vaccine. One of the things is that there was a very strong push to get this, as many people vaccinated as fast as they could. They did trials, but normally, even after you do trials, there's a lot of surveillance, which means you take a look to see what pops up. As you may remember, there were some serious side effects, and I don't even think the Johnson & Johnson vaccine specifically isn't even offered in the United States, and that was associated with the concern about heart inflammation in young men. There was a case of Guillain-Barré. That is a neurologic condition where there's antibodies attacks your nerves and can be fairly serious.
That's kind of what they call locked-in syndrome.
But then there's these. But those are the more serious. Those are the big serious ones because that's always being watched for. Then you get things that aren't life-threatening, but they are problematic. And that's what that article details, which everything from ringing in your ears to syndromes where you have something called POTS, which is you can pass out or feel dizzy when you get up quickly. This is a type of stuff that now we find out. Sometimes it takes a decade or longer to collect to see where the signal in all of this. Now, this is all happening amidst the sense that you want people to get vaccinated. You still have to do a risk-benefit analysis. And COVID is still worse than the side effects. Of course, for some people, they may have the the problems that are associated with that. And that's what I kind of always look at this. There's risk benefit with all vaccines.
And all medicine.
Everything. There's no such thing. I think that's axiomatic in medicine, meaning there's no such thing as a drug without a side effect. It just doesn't exist. And that's true for very gentle things like an aspirin to something like a COVID vaccine. Does that mean you shouldn't get vaccinated? No, no, no. Please get vaccinated. But we have to know more. And this is the type of stuff that needs to be collected.
And I think that one of the questions that the article raises is, or the concerns, is that maybe some people in the medical establishment were reluctant maybe to address these because of the really hyper anti-vax, you know, sentiment that was fed by a lot of misinformation. And they perhaps didn't want to feed that fire by giving attention to these few serious cases.
That's probably an accurate representation. I mean, anti-vaccine issues have impacted the number of people who get vaccinated. The vaccine's still a good thing, but normally you have the other side of the coin, which is there are some people that can run into side effects. And what that article told me is basically perhaps they didn't get enough attention and they shouldn't just be gaslit. No, this is on your head. It has something else. It merits being looked at.
Well, if you're just joining us, I'm talking to our own Dr. Joe Servin. He's here for his monthly house call to answer your healthcare questions. If you've got a call, you can reach us at 904-549-2937. You can also email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Dr. Joe, let's move on to another medical headline. It's a pretty important one these days. We know that the virus known as bird flu has been found now in 36 dairy cow herds across 9 states and now even in a dairy farm employee. Why is this concerning to scientists?
It's the avian flu is always a concern because a flu that jumps into mammals can then lead to another mutation that then turns into human-to-human transmission. And then we have ourselves a new virus and a potential mega problem like similar to what happened with COVID. It's something that has been monitored for a while because if a virus jumps from species to species and it becomes something that's easy to catch, and this appears to be fairly virulent, certainly amongst these mammals, the dairy cows, that can be a problem. And there was a human case in Texas, that worker, who has since recovered, but did have this particular strain of avian flu, and that became a worry. Now, they just published how he presented it. It was kind of unusual because his symptoms were that of conjunctivitis. His eyes were intensely red, and it's believed that he may have contacted it because even though he wore gloves, he did not wear respiratory equipment in these dairy herds, and he may have accidentally seeded the virus in his eyes. But it presented in this very unusual way, which is conjunctivitis.
His pink eye, we think of.
Exactly. And that's how it came to be known. Now, again, he's recovered. No one in the family got it, but it is a concern.
Well, we've got an email from Paul. He says, packed and overcrowded factory farming, over-reliance on industrial meat processing, and plain old greed have led to the increase of diseases spreading from one species to another. And he urges people to adopt a healthier and vegetarian lifestyle. You know, one thing that astonished me in looking at this issue was the fact that less so dairy cows, but cattle in general are fed something that's called poultry litter, which is essentially the leavings on the factory floor from a chicken factory. So, I mean, it just sounds ghastly, and it's hard to imagine that waste product is food, but I guess it's actually accepted, could be a way to transmit disease.
Yeah, that as I'm listening to this, and you know, I apologize if anyone's watching for my facial expressions. That is just gross. But the reality is, that is why and your in your emailer is absolutely right. Looking to the conditions of that, that is exactly a way that we can get ourselves into the situation where you have novel viruses, novel things that can really hurt all of us. So look at your labels. If you're going to eat meat or something like that, there are humanely raised labels now, which kind of helps to disseminate or avoid some of this type of stuff that you're talking about. But yeah, that is just not a pleasant thought. And number two, it can't be healthy. It just can't.
Well, this was an issue even back as far as mad cow disease, right?
Absolutely. Now in mad cow, which is very different, there was a concern that some cows, and this was, if I recall correctly, in Britain, they were fed like almost other cow stuff like that was on the floor. And this form of almost cannibalism, if you will, was one of the things that was found to be led to this particular disease. So it's just a reminder, it can come up in any way, shape, or form.
So unrelated to that, we have a call from Francis calling from McClenny. Good morning, Francis. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you, Dr. Joe?
I'm good. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. Listen, I was golfing yesterday, and I developed two large, I guess it's a fluid deposit under both of my eyes.
Huh. And how are you now, I guess would be my first question I'd have for you.
Well, they don't hurt. They don't bother me, but they're just very unsightly.
Huh. Although I can't practice medicine. I probably can't do that when I haven't seen someone in person. I will say, if someone was just saying that to me, I would first be worried, is there an allergy situation going out there? You know, if this is that time of year, if you were outdoors and something like that happens, I just wonder, grass, pollen, any of those type of things. And we are still very much in that season where something like that's happening. I would probably, if you could, like, contact primary care doctor that you see or provider, whoever that is, show them a picture. Those pictures are worth a lot. I wouldn't describe it. I would actually photograph it, upload it to a portal if you could, and see what they say, because that's typically how I think that may get to your answer there.
Thanks for calling.
Well, I'm planning on going to the urgent care center to have them take a look at it.
Perfect. I hope you recover quickly, whatever that is.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You bet.
All right. Thanks, Francis. I want to talk now about another headline that's kind of interesting, could be worrisome, could be for some people great news. Ozempic babies.
I never thought this is what I'd be talking about, but okay, we've talked about Ozempic for almost so many other things. For it's this great weight loss drug and anti-diabetes drug. So there have been, it came out of TikTok, so this is out of social media reports, a lot of these anecdotal stories of people who were previously not able to conceive, suddenly pregnant. Now, what that means is unclear, because one of the interesting points is that when the drug was being trialed in the United States with subjects, pregnant women and women who could become pregnant were excluded, because that is a standard approach. So here we are now, you have a phenomenon, everyone is using this, and it's unclear whether it's a direct impact on fertility, or is it somehow that if you lose the weight, your hormones become more able to kind of like level off to kind of lead to pregnancy, or does it render a birth control pill less effective?
And we do know that obesity can be a hindrance to fertility.
Absolutely. And so if you lose this weight, does that, when you get into normal weight or below it, does it change things? And that's a failure. The fact that we don't know that in this situation, I think is terrible. That just tells us that we have to figure out a better way when you trial this stuff out. because no one knows. And the other thing is, we don't know the impact of the drug on an unborn child. In fact, the manufacturers say you should discontinue this 2 months before you even conceive because they don't know.
And so now people are finding out they're pregnant while they're on the drug in some cases, and then taking themselves off the drug immediately. But we know that this drug does have this reputation for coming with some really, possibly rapid regain of weight. The women who are pregnant are describing just unbelievable, urges to eat, unlike their previous pregnancies or, unlike what's typically expected. And whether that's a Ozempic side effect or not, I think we don't know.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of what we do know. Let's say if you're not pregnant and you stop the drug, we do know that people do tend to rebound and gain the weight because a lot of times what it does is it just shuts down your desire to eat. And then when you're off of it, that goes higher. No one really understands what happens when you shut it down and you're pregnant. I mean, that's just asking for problems. I would say if you want to become pregnant, or please come off that drug, but under the guise of medical care, because there's just so many unknowns.
And there's so many people who seem to be just ordering this drug online and not going through a doctor.
There's a black market for this because there's shortages left and right for Ozempic and its cousin sister drugs. And the demand is so out of control. Please, please, if you're pregnant, this is one of those things to kind of talk to someone about.
It's good advice. I want to shift to a topic that's getting a lot of attention today and this whole week. So May is Mental Health Awareness Month. The city of Jacksonville has launched a mental health initiative to educate the public. And there's actually going to be a phone bank here tomorrow at WJCT from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. What do we know about the need in the community and what this phone bank is going to address?
What we know is that mental health issues are a problem everywhere in the U.S. Jacksonville is clearly in that mix. This is a fantastic approach from the city of Jacksonville to really try to let people know there's help out there. There's a hotline. There are sources, or at least provide those resources. So I applaud the mayor's office, Dr. Joshi, the chief health officer, for putting this out there, because this is one of those areas that I think could help a lot of people, because there's such a level of depression, anxiety out there, and people don't have to suffer so much.
And especially with young people, an issue that is, great concern. And, one of the messages they want to get out is the 988, which is a mental health lifeline. But there are other services available that people should be aware of.
Absolutely. A lot of people struggle in terms of finding those mental health resources. They do exist. They have been ramping up in multiple different areas around town. So definitely, if you can, participate.
All right. The number for that phone bank tomorrow is 904-516-2511. If you want to call, that's from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Dr. Joe, it's so nice to have you here. Thanks for coming for a house call.
And always a pleasure.
Stick around. Up next, arts, crafts, food trucks, and a chance to meet Daniel Tiger.
Amelia Island celebrates Wild Amelia Nature Festival on May 18th at Main Beach Park. Experience eco tours and exhibits, live animals, kids activities, food trucks, live music, and more. More info at ameliaisland.com/wildamelia.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. When people are hurt through no fault of their own, answering who, what, when, where, why, and how is critical to proving the truth. More at terrellhogan.com.
Life South Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with Life South helps save lives. More at lifesouth.org to find a blood drive near you.
Join WJCT and PNC Grow Up Great for Be My Neighbor Day at WJCT Studios on Saturday, May 11th. At this free festival, meet Daniel Tiger and friends, visit community helpers, sing and dance with Mr. Joe, create arts and crafts, and much more. Learn all about being a caring neighbor by reserving your spot today at wjct.org/events.
From Robert Johnson to B.B. King, from Stevie Ray Vaughan to Gary Clark Jr., the best in classic and modern blues can be found on Blues Horizon every Sunday night at 7 on WJCT 89.9 HD3.
Third parties are nothing new in U.S. politics, but this year more people are paying attention to them. That's being fueled by consistently low popularity numbers for both presumptive presidential candidates. A new poll found that 56% of voters viewed Donald Trump unfavorably. That number was 54% for President Biden. What impact are third-party candidates having on the 2024 election? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
That music just makes you happy. Well, we're back. Space travel superstar readers and Daniel Tiger. WJCT is opening its doors and rolling out the red carpet for you. It's the 8th annual Be My Neighbor Day. And here to talk about it is Cersei Lenoble, WJCT's Grants and Outreach, Education Outreach Manager. I'll get it out. Welcome, Cersei.
Thanks.
And WJCT board member and former chief operating officer, Karen Fagans. Welcome, Karen.
So glad to be here. Thank you.
So, Cersei, this is my first Be My Neighbor Day. As I'm fairly new to this station, what is Be My Neighbor Day?
Oh, Be My Day is a day of fun and learning and new experiences for families. There are inflatable games. There are food trucks. You get to meet all kinds of special neighbors is kind of the theme and learn how to be caring neighbors. So we have helpers here, JSO, JFRD, Safe Kids, Baptist Health, with On Our Sleeves program, and then also get free books from the library, or not free books from the library, but Read USA will be here, and the library will be here, and New Worlds Reading Initiative will be here to share information, and we have a reading corner, and like you said, the Space Travel Dome, which is an inflatable kind of...
Planetarium.
Yes, thank you.
I was amazed to hear that such exists. I didn't even know that there was such a thing. But you can kind of go into it and they'll be doing stargazing lessons.
Actually, they have a show. You hear a story about two mice and the moon.
Oh, sweet. So you talked about teaching people to be good neighbors. And why is that important, particularly now?
Well, I mean, I don't think that's hard to explain. Especially we like to start with the younger children to help them experience the different people in their neighborhood and how we can all help and learn how to care for each other. And some of the activities that the kids will be able to do is they're going to decorate a placemat, and we get them laminated and we take them to Almost Home Daybreak, which is an adult daycare center for the elderly with dementia. They'll be able to decorate a bookmark that we will share with people learning to read. So simple things that they can do and places they can go and explore. And so it just kind of tries to open their world to the possibilities just in their neighborhood. They don't have to travel or...
And Karen, you are now with PNC Bank, and that is obviously one of the event supporters. But she's talking about, you know, crafts that are not necessarily something that you're making for yourself, but you're actually making for other people. These placemats that go to this, you know, facility where adults are with dementia, or a bookmark for someone that you care about. Why is it important to have them sort of make outward looking crafts? And what lessons does that impart?
Well, that's one of the most unique things about Be My Neighbor Day, is really that it's focused helping young kids at that very early age to realize what is around them in the community. And every stop, everywhere they stop, when they're interacting with the firemen, when they're interacting with poison control, when they're interacting with all of these different stations, It's all about what can you do to give back to your community, which is such an important message for all of us. I think the parents probably take some of that away from the day as well. But especially when kids are really small, having that opportunity to think about what else is out there in the world and what they can give back.
And I know that one of the entertainers or that's going to be there is Mr. Joe. Mm-hmm. He is a literacy advocate, but he's a really fun performer. Tell us a little bit about Hello, Mr. Joe.
Well, Hello, Mr. Joe. We're so excited. We had him here a couple years ago, but he's back and he's going to be participating in our new to this event, a Reader's Corner, where he's going to read stories, share some stories with the families. He's also going to be outside singing and dancing and playing with the kids, which he loves to do and does so well. He used to be at the library. So we've got all these partners that are connected and supporting each other. And it's just a great experience for everyone.
I saw one of the Facebook comments on the Be My Neighbor Day post, and it was like, Daniel Tiger and Mr. Joe? Well, we have to go.
Yeah, Daniel Tiger, of course, a character derived mm-hmm. from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. So this is indoor, outdoor. I know that we're participating too. The First Coast Connect team is going to be here in the studio welcoming people and letting them come through and maybe even test out the mics.
Yeah, let the kids hear themselves on the radio.
Yeah, but this is a pretty much an all-day deal, right?
It's from 10 to 2.
Okay.
But yeah, we take over the parking lot, all the space downstairs at WJCT Studios, everything.
And I know, Karen, some of the segments have already been reserved out, so you do have to make a reservation to come.
Yes, you can go online, make a reservation, and that's so WJCT can plan. And I think, you know, we're trying to describe what this day is like. It's really hard to explain what it's like until you experience it. So if you have young kids, I definitely recommend this. PNC supports Be My Neighbor Day across the country, but I really strongly feel the WJCT Be My Neighbor Day is probably one of the best in the country. It's an incredible event.
Well, you can find that information at the WJCT website. Karen Fagan, Cersei Lenoble, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our program. We encourage your feedback and suggestions, and you can send either to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. If you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock or find our entire archive at wjct.org or on your favorite podcast platform. Join us tomorrow when we take a deep dive into the scandal that involved not just JEA, but FPL, phony ghost candidates, and a statewide effort to undermine elections. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.